The topic I want to speak about tonight, I called Hope, Fear, and Awakening. I chose this particular topic because it's been very much a part of my life over the last 6 months. And I've noticed in my work with meditation students, with coaching clients and life coaching, with people I meet with for spiritual direction, that it appears that I'm not alone in experiencing hope and fear and that which lies between the two. At times it's been rather garden variety and familiar in the way that we experience preferences on a day-to-day basis. And at other times, given the global circumstances that we're currently living with, it's actually been quite intense. In a way that pushed the limits for me in terms of my sense of tolerance and felt like it was stretching me in a particular way that I saw a sense of opportunity in. Because in the years I've been on this planet, although the Vietnam War years were intense in a particular way and there was a tremendous amount of polarization in our country, at that time, I can't say that it compared in any way to the level of polarization we're seeing at this time. And when you combine that particular quality with what's happening on the level of the ecological crisis in regard to social justice issues and in regard to concerns about the COVID pandemic that we've all been living with for a number of months, I think it's quite clear that this is an extraordinary and challenging time. One of the things that I do when I feel that I'm being challenged in this way is turn toward the teachings, both the Buddhist teachings and other contemplative wisdom teachings that have helped to guide me through my life over the years. So when I noticed what was happening and spoke to a couple of close friends and colleagues about it. It was very clear to me that I was not alone and that there was much to be learned from the teachings. One particular close friend I spoke to, who is a retired psychotherapist, spoke to me about it in terms of his views of people who are optimists and people who are pessimists, which I found rather interesting. And of course, as a psychotherapist, that was one of the lenses through which he observed the way he sees himself and other people dealing with the fluctuation of hope and fear that to me seems built into our current circumstance. It was interesting for me because I asked him at one point how he defined a pessimist. He thought for a moment, he said, well, that's easy. A pessimist is someone who lives with an optimist, essentially, yeah. Another way to look at it that I found helpful was a comment made by an American-born Tibetan teacher familiar to some of you, perhaps Lama Surya Das. When he talked about optimism and pessimism, he had this to say in that regard. Buddha Dharma does not teach that everything is suffering. What Buddhism does say is that life by its nature is difficult, flawed, and imperfect. For most of us, this fact of life hardly merits a news flash. Who among us has a perfect life? Of course, we would like it to be delightful and wonderful all of the time. But it's not going to happen. From a Buddhist point of view, this is not a judgment of life's joys or sorrows. This is a simple, down-to-earth, matter-of-fact description. The fact is that we will all experience ups and downs, no matter who we are. That's part of the roller coaster ride. Buddhism is neither pessimistic nor optimistic. It is realistic. And I was struck by that comment in part because What attracted me to Buddhism initially when I was a 21-year-old college student some years back was the fact that Buddhism did seem to help me look at reality as it actually is in a realistic manner. For example, the Buddha was not presented, particularly in the Theravada tradition, as a supernatural being. He was presented as a human being, just like each of us. He had backaches. He got food poisoning. He tried to manage squabbles in the Sangha. And he, in many ways, was human just as we are. Yeah. And that appealed to me because that said to me that if he was able to actually come to the essence of understanding suffering and the end of suffering, and he was a human being just like me, that suggested to me that I had the same potential and possibility that he did. And I believe that to be true. And so that actually shaped much of my adult life, the realization that that was a true and real possibility for me and for every human being. I think if we're going to have an understanding of hope and fear that are useful, it's very helpful to understand what we mean when we use these terms, because there are different understandings. Yeah. I'd like to talk about them separately initially, and then point out the way in which I see them to be sides of the same coin. I noticed when I was living in Nepal, for example, that the Tibetan lamas that I trained with almost inevitably talked about hope and fear as if it were one word. That phrase was used in a particular way. And we'll talk about why a little bit later. When I look at my experience of fear, however, if I'm really honest and I'm willing to embrace my humanity and all the vulnerability that's associated with it, I can see why I've been experiencing this ping-pong match between hope and fear over recent months. If I get quiet and I feel into my body and I ask myself what some of the things are that I've been feeling fear in relation to, a long list comes up. For example, I'm afraid of contracting COVID myself. I'm also afraid that someone close to me, my wife, my daughter, one of my close friends, students, people in our Sangha, people I feel a deep connection to, might come down with COVID as well. I'm afraid that if that happens to me or one of these people, that one of us will die. And I'm afraid of the pain that that loss might cause. Having a wife who's a physical therapist and a scientist who has a great deal of interest in public health, I get regular reports on what's happening in the public health community. And another fear that that brought up was the fear that there'll be another pandemic that follows the one that we're experiencing now. When I consider the state of our current economy, both nationally and globally, a certain amount of fear comes up for me because I have grave concerns about what's going to unfold over the next few years in particular. Another fear that comes into play I mentioned earlier has to do with environmental degradation and what's happening on the level of the sensitive ecology of our planet. Living in Colorado, for example, we live now every summer with an ongoing concern and anxiety about wildfires in the mountains in the area where I live, or fires like the ones we're seeing in California at this time. On and off throughout the summer, we lived with a certain amount of smoke in our environment and a sense of smelling the fires, both in Colorado and in California. Additional fears come up for me in relation to the state of our national politics and what kind of hell might break loose in relation to the upcoming election. Now, I could go on for another 20 minutes, but I'm afraid that everyone would just leave the meeting. So I'll stop there for the moment. And at the same time, I think it's important for all of us to recognize that a common misunderstanding of Buddhist teachings is that it somehow involves denying our humanity and our vulnerability. I don't understand it that way at all. My understanding of what it means to awaken is to be fully alive and to learn to live on two levels simultaneously at the same time. What usually in Buddhism and other contemplative traditions is called the relative level, upon which we're human and fragile and vulnerable, and we live in a body identified with a personality, and also on the absolute level, or what Tibetans call the ultimate level, which has to do with the level upon which our true nature, or our Buddha nature, or what some traditions call our Christ consciousness, or true self with a capital S, is ultimately the identity that we experience ourselves to be. Yeah, our willingness to work with our fear is part of how we integrate our humanity, as I understand it, with our true nature. So one of the things we can look at here is what the teachings have to offer us by way of guidelines for exploring fear and for developing a wise relationship to it. For example, let's begin by recognizing that the list of fears I just shared with you is not neurotic or psychotic. That is to say, these are realistic fears. And these may very well be situations that some of us are currently dealing with or will be dealing with in the future. It's also true that there are times when we have difficult psychiatric and psychological experiences in which our fears and anxieties become tremendously exaggerated. And then there's a version of what the Buddha called the second arrow that comes into play when we add additional unnecessary fear and anxiety to the existential fear and anxiety that's very much a part of the reality that we're living with. When we look at the teachings, however, there are guidelines for how to integrate and work with these experiences in a wise way. One of them is to begin by turning toward versus away the experience of fear itself. Now, those of us who are familiar with the teachings on the five hindrances know that the second of the five hindrances that are energies that obscure our capacity to see reality clearly, the second of those hindrances is aversion. And essentially, fear is a form of aversion. Habitually, if we don't train our hearts and minds to stay awake, we simply avoid fear and anxiety and go to great lengths to distract ourselves from having to feel the discomfort of it. The problem with that, of course, is that it makes it very difficult to see reality clearly, which is a necessary prerequisite for engaging with reality in a skillful way. So we begin by turning toward fear and befriending it and recognizing that oftentimes it's an important and valuable teacher for us. It provides information for us. We've come to understand it when we befriend it as a natural, inherent part of who we are as human beings. And we eventually understand why science reminds us regularly that it's built in by evolutionary biology to who we are and how we function in the world. Yeah. Another aspect of this that comes into play is one that's changed for me over the years. When I first got involved with meditation training and studying yoga and training as a yoga teacher, I had a certain image in my mind that I projected onto the various spiritual teachers that I studied and practiced with. And I imagined them to be fearless, utterly fearless in a particular way, somewhat like spiritual samurai. And while that's true to a certain extent on some level, as I lived my life and began to mature psychologically and emotionally, I came to a new and different understanding of fearlessness, which involved what one of my teachers called feeling the fear and doing it anyway. I also came to see that working with fear offered us an opportunity to learn about what the teachings call discriminating wisdom. That is, sometimes when we feel fear, the message is, don't go there. If it's 2 o'clock in the morning and I'm standing on a street corner in Oakland, California, and the whole street is filled with crack houses and I feel fear, it's wise for me to not go down that street by myself. Discriminating wisdom suggests that I would be harmed or hurt badly. On the other hand, before I moved to Nepal in the 1980s, I read way too many books on how sick I was going to get. And I had a certain amount of fear about going to a place where I knew very few people, didn't speak the language, and intuitively sensed that I would go through major transformations in my life. Yeah. At the same time, every aspect of my intuition said to me, it was the right thing for me to do. And that was a feel the fear and do it anyway kind of moment. And I feel tremendous gratitude for that experience of having the opportunity to study with many teachers from the last generation of lamas, most of whom aren't alive anymore, but who were extraordinary teachers, and in the 80s, very available, such that we could walk in and visit informally the way you would with a next door neighbor, basically. Pema Chodron talks about fear in her book, The Places That Scare You. And she describes an experience that a young woman wrote to her about, in which we can see what I mean when I say fear can be a valuable source of learning and information. She writes, "A young woman wrote to me about finding herself in a small town in the Middle East, surrounded by people jeering, yelling, and threatening to throw stones at her and her friends simply because they were American. Of course, she was terrified. And what happened to her is interesting. Suddenly, she identified with every person throughout history who had ever been scorned and hated. She understood what it was like to be despised for any reason, ethnic group, racial background, sexual preference, gender. Something cracked wide open in her, and she stood in the shoes of millions of oppressed people and saw with a new perspective. She even understood her shared humanity with those who hated her. This sense of deep connection, of belonging to the same family, is bodhicitta, sometimes translated as altruistic intention." And of course, as a lot of us have experienced, it's that bodhicitta that allows us to become wounded healers. One of the great realizations that I think we experience as we mature in the spiritual life is related to a comment Ram Dass made years ago that at first I found quite offensive. I really didn't want to hear it. He said to us at one of his talks, suffering from a spiritual standpoint is functional. And I've explored that statement over the years, and it's clearly not desirable. I wouldn't wish it upon myself or anyone else. And at the same time, having lived some years of life at this point, I can look at the times I have felt frightened, like this young woman in the Middle East, which clearly were times of suffering, or times when I was waiting for biopsy results in relation to a possible cancer diagnosis. Many other situations I witnessed when I directed a hospice program for a number of years. And I can see how the suffering in our lives functions to deepen our compassion. There's a way in which it turns us into a wounded healer. Because when someone talks to me about their grief, if I know grief below the level of my neck, and I know it in my heart and my body from my own experience, I will be able to show up for and resonate with that person with a much greater degree of empathy and compassion than I would if I didn't know that experience in my own life. Yeah. The same is true with fear. So I'd like to do this brief experiment that I mentioned earlier that I have in mind. If you have something to write with and a pen or a paper, if you'd please take that and have it nearby. And what we're going to do here, this is a guided meditation. And part of it, I will make some suggestions to you to jot some notes. And this is completely voluntary. You'll get full credit from a grading standpoint, whether you participate or not. There's no right or wrong way to do it, because we do it in the spirit of discovery and seeing what we can learn. But just to give you a brief overview, I'm going to lead you into a brief guided reflection. During the latter part of it, I'm going to suggest that you jot a few notes, and then we'll bring it to a close and see if you have anything you want to share about it or talk about it. We'll see where it takes you, okay? So to begin with, if you'd find an appropriate meditative posture that allows you to experience a balance of alertness and relaxation, as we often do in meditation, you might begin by allowing your eyes to gently close or to be slightly downcast with a soft focus if you're accustomed to practicing in that manner. And take a few moments to simply relax by riding the breath with your attention, letting the outside world go for a few moments. If or when your mind wanders off, no need to judge yourself, but with kindness and rigor, gently redirect your attention to the felt experience of the breath in the body. Now, I'd like you to consider what one of your fears is at this particular time. I shared my list with you, at least an abbreviated version of it. Just take a moment and get in touch with one of the fears that you've experienced during this stay-at-home period that perhaps weighs on you, comes up maybe in the middle of the night sometimes, or during the day as well. And to the extent that you can, if there are more than one, choose one fear that you'd like to explore in this exercise. And I'd like you to identify it clearly to yourself by simply saying to yourself, I am afraid of, or I am afraid that. And repeat that statement to yourself once or twice so that you can allow yourself to befriend that reality. I am afraid of, or I'm afraid that. And once you've identified this fear, allow yourself to experience the fear. That is, continue to pay mindful attention. And I'd like you to notice how this fear affects your body. Notice how this fear affects your breathing. Your muscle tension. How does your mind react to this fear? What other feelings come up when you get in touch with this fear? Now I'd like you to ask yourself, what are you afraid would happen if what you fear actually came to pass? What are you afraid would happen if what you fear actually came to pass? And if that happened, what might happen to you? And if that happened, what are you afraid would happen next? Continue in this way, and now begin to jot down your responses. Explore the fear behind the fear, until you reach what seems like a very basic level, or the most basic level of your fear. And as you do this, notice your feelings, your thoughts, and your physical responses, particularly when you notice what feels like a basic level of fear. Take another minute or two if you would find that helpful. If you've already completed writing, you might just look over what you wrote, not with a critical eye, but just try it on to see how it fits for you. And now put your notebook aside for a moment. Go back inside with your attention. And I'd like you to use your imagination fully and completely to imagine yourself moving into a very deep and centered place in yourself, where you are in touch with your fear, but not consumed by it. Now, what truth do you know about all of this that you just wrote and reflected upon? What is your deepest, truest knowing about this fear? You may or may not be able to put it into words, but you can feel it. Let it move into your body. Breathe it into all of your cells. Your deepest, truest knowing about this fear. And when you're ready, I'd like you to once again take your pad or notebook and write something brief about this fear. If you prefer, you can draw an image. You could create a poem or a song if you want to write a few lines. But see if you can capture what you understand on the deepest level about this fear that you've been exploring. Take another minute or so if you'd like. Okay, so let me go on a little bit. I said at the outset, we would explore how we understand what fear is. And also we would explore how we understand what hope is. What actually triggered my desire and supported my desire to talk about this topic was what I mentioned earlier in regard to how many people I was coming across who were experiencing what I was in relation to hope and fear. And then what tipped it and led me to want to speak about it just recently to my Sangha here in Boulder and also to you folks was a piece of writing I read by Roshi Joan Halifax, who's a teacher whose work I appreciate a great deal and whose center I've had the good fortune to teach at one time. Roshi Joan wrote a piece on what she called wise hope that really spoke to something I'd been feeling for many years but had never been able to put words to. She writes, "I have long been troubled by the notion of hope. In discoveries through my practice life and my service life, I am now opening to another view of hope, what I'm calling wise hope. We know that ordinary hope is based in desire, wanting an outcome that could well be different from what might actually happen. To make matters worse, not getting what we hoped for is often experienced as a misfortune. If we look deeply, we realize that anyone who is conventionally hopeful has an expectation that always hovers in the background, the shadow of fear that one's wishes will not be fulfilled. Ordinary hope, then, is a form of suffering. This kind of hope is a nemesis and a partner of fear." This is what I was saying earlier about why the Tibetans talk about hope and fear as one process. Then she goes on to say, "It's when we discern courageously and at the same time realize we don't know what will happen that wise hope comes alive. In the midst of improbability and possibility is where the imperative to act rises up. Wise hope is not seeing things unrealistically, but rather seeing things as they are, including the truth of impermanence, as well as the truth of suffering, both its existence and the possibility of its transformation, for better or for worse. Our journey through life is one of peril and possibility, and sometimes both at once. How can we stand on the threshold between suffering and freedom, between futility and hope, and remain informed by both worlds?" So what is it that she's saying here? Well, on one level, she's talking about what I earlier referred to as the two different levels that we live on, what the poet Rilke called the double realm. On the level of our small selves, our humanity, our egos and our personalities, conventional hope is a natural human response, and I believe it's unavoidable. We have preferences, we have desires, we'd rather have this outcome or that outcome. We'd like to see this person elected or that person elected. We hope the biopsy results say one thing and not another, and so forth, right? If we own our humanity and embrace it and see it as sacred, as I believe it to be, we will experience the ups and downs of conventional hope. At the same time, what I hear Roshi Joan to be saying is that there's another kind of hope that's associated with our true nature, that's associated with our capacity for loving awareness and deep compassion, which is not attached to outcomes in the way that we are with conventional hope. What this is pointing toward is what we traditionally in Buddhist training call the path of the Bodhisattva. That is, we have an aspiration to be an instrument of the Dharma or of the divine, depending upon our particular perspective, and to be used by something greater than ourselves to help alleviate suffering and bring joy and well-being into the world. And in a very human way, the Bodhisattva path invites us to do the best we can to be instruments in just that way. At the same time, what we come to realize as we deepen our identification with our true nature is that ours is to simply do our best to express our wisdom and compassion in the world as effectively as we can. And we don't want to get caught in the illusion that we have a great deal of control over the outcome. We do have a significant amount of control over our intention, which is why we work with practices like the Bodhisattva vow, or why millions of people around the world who are self-identified as Buddhists sit down to meditate and say things like, "I take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, and for the benefit of all beings, without exception, I practice the Dharma here and now." Yeah. The hope is clearly there that the individual will be able to be an instrument of benefit in the world. At the same time, there's an ongoing lesson in non-attachment to the result. And this is a hot fire, let's be honest about it, particularly when we're living in a charged emotional environment like the one we're living in now. At the same time, I think because we're living in the world we're living in, each in our own way, we are being called to step up and make the effort to function as a bodhisattva at this time, to become what the Dalai Lama calls a force for good. Because if ever our planet and the living beings on it needed the wisdom and compassion that Buddhist teachings for over 2,500 years have been cultivating, I would suggest this is one such time when we really desperately need authentic wisdom and compassion. Coming from a place in which a worldview of we are all us and there is no them plays a fundamental role. One of the people that I studied years ago in the 60s and 70s when I was interested in integrating inner work from a spiritual standpoint with outer service and activism was a Christian man named Reverend Jim Wallace, who started a publication called The Sojourners and was very active in the civil rights movement and a number of other movements. When I was preparing this talk, I remembered him because he was always someone I associated hope with. He was so courageous in his involvement in the civil rights movement. So I looked up, I just Googled his name and I came across an interview with him. Interestingly, in the context of the interview, he used the word hope, and the interviewer said to him, "What do you mean by hope? How do you understand what hope is?" Right? And Wallace said such an interesting thing. He said, "Hope is believing in spite of the evidence and watching the evidence change." Think about that, right? Hope is believing in spite of the evidence and watching the evidence change. And what this points out to us that I think is so important is that if we fix on certain ideas about hope and fear, if we lock into a view, what the Buddha called attachment to view, we basically end up oftentimes precluding another possibility because we're made cognitively in such a way that we can't perceive something that is outside of our view without a major paradigm shift. And that doesn't happen very easily when we're locked into a view and attached to it. So this notion of Roshi Jones of wise hope has an element of hope to it in the same way that Reverend Jim Wallace is talking about, because it's not a hope that is attached to a specific outcome. It's a hope that's rooted in a wise understanding of impermanence and a recognition that none of us knows for sure what's going to happen in 2 seconds, 2 minutes, or 2 years. That when we live in presence, and the Bodhisattva is one who practices making the present moment the reference point for reality in their life, that presence allows us to be open and to experience the wise hope that Roshi Joan was talking about. So what is it that I'm really trying to say here, if I tried to sum it up, because I want to allow some time for us to have some discussion about this? I'm suggesting a few particular points that I would invite you to take away and reflect upon so you can see if they're useful in your own life and spiritual practice. One of them is that it's of central importance that if we're interested in an engaged spirituality, that we integrate our humanness with our deeper nature, that we don't spiritually bypass all of the emotional vulnerability and fragility and suffering associated with our humanness, and that at the same time, we recognize that humanness to be part of the curriculum that allows us to come to know our deeper nature through the innate capacity we have for self-transcendence, that is, transcending an exclusive identification with our small self so that we can come to know our true nature in such a way that it informs the way we move through the world as a small self. I also suggested that the experiences of hope and fear, which can be seen individually and also as an integrated concept, are natural at this time on our planet with all of what's going on in our world. My encouragement has been to turn toward hope and fear and to develop a wise relationship to them rather than to respond aversively to either one of them. That is, to embrace and integrate them into our experience as part of our wholeness as human beings. And then I offered some suggestions of how we could understand fear and how we could understand hope. And we did our experiment to see what you perhaps got in touch with when we worked with that experiential piece. And here at the end, I'm suggesting that the Bodhisattva tradition in historical Buddhism has always been about being willing to turn toward hope and fear and work with them in such a way that they become a part of our skillfulness as we move through the world. Just as that young woman in the Middle East learned a great deal about fear and humanity in terms of the fact that she became a wounded healer as a result of that experience, we can each do that with the fear and the other forms of suffering that we experience in relation to this pandemic and a lot of the social and global challenges that we're living with. My sense is that if we're willing to accept the curriculum we're being presented with, our possibilities for transformation and awakening are absolutely extraordinary. So I'll close with a comment that Ram Dass made, in which he described this process, this transformation that's inherent within the process of spiritual awakening in this way. What is happening to you is nothing less than death and rebirth. What is dying is the entire way in which you understood who you are and how it all is. What is being reborn is the child of the Spirit for whom all things are new. This process of attending an ego that is dying at the same time that you are going through a birth process is awesome. Be gentle and honor that, the small self, which is dying, as well as that, the true nature, who is being born. Well, we're coming up on, looks like your time, 8:45. My time, dinner. And how about if we do a brief dedication of merit just to close? Yeah. If you want to just take a moment and come into a quiet position, let's recognize for a moment how fortunate we are to be able to come together this way, technology and all, even if we can't come together in the physical settings we're accustomed to be with people of like heart and like mind who share our aspirations to become a force for good, to awaken ourselves, and in the process, learn to be more effective in helping others to wake up, and to hopefully, each in our own way, have a positive influence on the challenges that we're dealing with. Excuse me. I'd like to close with an ancient Buddhist blessing called the Puttanumudana that some of you might be familiar with. So just hear these words as much with your heart as with your mind. Just as water flowing in the streams and rivers fills the ocean, thus may all your moments of goodness touch and benefit all beings, those here now and those gone before. May all of your wishes be soon fulfilled, as completely as the moon on a full moon night, as successfully as from the wish-fulfilling gem. May all dangers be averted. May all disease leave you. May no obstacles come across your way. And may you enjoy happiness and long life. May those who are always respectful, honoring the way of the elders, prosper in the four blessings of old age, beauty, happiness, and strength. May it be so. Thank you for your kind attention. It's been a delight to be with you this evening. Be well. Stay healthy.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.